Good morning, everyone. The National Broadcasting Company brings you now a roundup of the latest news with reports by members of our foreign staff and by Ray Henley from Washington. We take you first to the Middle East. Go ahead, Cairo.
That the flow of Axis reinforcement and supply be cut down. To reduce this flow, Axis harbors and shipping must be attacked, and the German and Italian air forces, which protect the enemy supply lines, must be disabled. A modern warplane, once in the air, is a deadly engine of death and destruction, something to be reckoned with. But on the ground, it is a flimsy thing, vulnerable to both bombs and bullets. The place to destroy an airplane, then, is on the ground. And that's just where the RAF is doing it. As far as the Army was concerned, yesterday was a blank. But in the air, it was a different story. Fire once more literally fell from on high and consumed a good part of the airplane and another Axis airdrome. Despite the mass raid on airfields near Daba Sunday, the new assault caught the Axis completely off guard. Perhaps because British medium bombers plastered other drones in the Daba vicinity Sunday night and drew a heavy air cover there to protect the German nest after the damage was done. But the RAF struck 30 miles further west, near a place called Fuka. More than 100 Allied planes, light bombers, fighter bombers, fighters, carried out the raid. The light bombers dropped wide dispersal bombs, bombs which explode instantly on hitting the ground, throw white-hot metal 550 yards in every direction. Several bombs fell among 25 enemy machines. There were two direct hits, and 10 bombs fell so close that damage was certain. It's doubtful if one of the many Nazi planes escaped damage. But the fighter bombers dived in later to add to the havoc, and the fighters followed up with machine guns blazing. On the ground, Junkers, Heinkel, and Savoia bombers, Junkers transport, Mackie and Messerschmitt fighters, all caught too many bullets or bomb fragments. One fighter-bomber pilot said afterwards, "We all did 110 in a gun in a long procession, stopped talking in the rows of groups of aircraft we saw were riddled like sieves by our fires. I saw bits and pieces of wrecked aircraft flying amidst the dust." But these long-range fighters, armed with machine guns and cannons, struck more directly at enemy supplies by attacking a convoy of small vessels in the Mediterranean off Sidi Barani. There were three barges, two schooners, one tanker, and an Italian E-boat, a fast, well-armed motorboat. Two of the barges were set afire. The tanker left smoky, the other boat damaged. Overhead, an escorting Messerschmitt sheered off, and an Italian Fiat fighter did a nosedive, apparently on its own initiative, into the sea. This is Grant Spahr returning you to New York.
Now to Britain. For our report this morning from Robert St. John, we take you now to London.
This is London. 5 minutes ago, the Admiralty told the story of a little naval battle in the English Channel early this morning.
Light British patrol boats ran into a fleet of enemy trawlers and powerfully armed flak ships, convoying a big Nazi supply boat. One of the Nazi trawlers was set on fire. The rest of the fleet was forced back to port. And it was all done by a few little British coastal craft. A couple of hours ago, thousands of Belgians here in England celebrated their Independence Day. They staged a big military parade. Belgian sailors, airmen, infantrymen, artillerymen, tank drivers. It was disclosed for the first time that the Belgians have their own parachute units here in Britain, trained, ready, and waiting for that day when they'll get the signal to drop down onto their own homeland and help drive out the Nazis. They were told, however impatient you may feel in your preparation for the battle of liberation, be ready. Today, the powerful London Times took a frank look at the Russian front, admitted the gravity of the situation, concluded that it's not enough for Russia's allies merely to live up to their written promise of delivering so many tanks, planes, and guns to the Eastern Front. The Times says it is our urgent and overriding duty to make sure that the fighting resources of the Russian army are maintained, at least until our intervention in Europe forces the Germans to relax their pressure in the East.
For 5 days now, I've been listening in to broadcasts from Rome and Berlin and from so-called freedom stations, which the Nazis would like us to believe are hidden somewhere in the rolling English countryside, but which actually send out their foolish chatter from somewhere in Europe. If you don't think the idea of a second front in Europe has the Hitler-Mussolini team worried, you ought to hear these Axis radio commentators. They've been filling the air with the most conflicting, ridiculous lot of words I ever heard. The net effect on a normally sane person is like listening to the mumbled jumble of a man in a nightmare. The Axis would like the British people to believe, the people here and in America want a second front, but the leaders don't. Or two, that the leaders do, but the people don't. And the Axis would like the British people, one, to raise a rumpus because no second front has been opened, or two, to stir up trouble because a second front is about to be opened. Most amusing and paradoxical of all is the claim made by a Berlin broadcaster who says Germany is bored and indifferent to the second front idea. Well, I've never heard anyone who was bored and indifferent having such a case of jitters as the Axis seems to be having right now. And now this is Robert St. John in London, returning you to New York.
Reports trickle into neutral Sweden from the warring nations of Europe. David Anderson, NBC reporter there, is ready now with his analysis. And we take you to Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. The great battles now being waged along the lower reaches of the Don are still the main subject of attention here in the north. Since last I spoke to you about the Russian front, a marked change seems to denote the German line of attack. Based on reports from Berlin, I stated before that the general German drive seemed to be concentrated in a region north, west, and east of Rostov. The purpose for this, according to Berlin reports, was to encircle large forces of Timoshenko's army and a press on toward Rostov, one of the important keys to the Caucasus. These Berlin reports also indicated that the Germans would carry their drive into the Caucasus before attempting to reach the Volga to the east, particularly in this case, Stalingrad. Now, however, the German High Command has stated that the German attacks are now proceeding both toward the south and east. Military experts here say that this eastward drive is definitely directed toward Stalingrad. In fact, these experts claim that the Germans must liquidate the large reinforcements which Timoshenko has in the region of Stalingrad before exposing their left flank in any operation into the Caucasus. With this new development, Colonel Brass, the military correspondent of Dagens Nyheter, offers some excellent suggestions concerning the continued developments on the Eastern Front. Dealing with the Russian defense of Stalingrad, he says that Timoshenko will probably try to concentrate his defense of this town east of the Don River, in the relatively small space between the Don and the Volga. This will be done, he says, because of the difficulties of transporting large troops across the Don in the face of German air attacks, and also because this small area would favor defense rather than offense, a distinct disadvantage for the attacking Germans. Also, instead of a German frontal attack on Stalingrad, the colonel thinks that the Germans will try to encircle the defenders of Stalingrad from the north and south. As far as the southern front is concerned, contrary to the opinions expressed in other countries, Colonel Brass says that the Germans will probably try to bypass Rostov. He bases his opinion on German reports that Rostov is a mighty fortress. Reports from both Berlin and Moscow today are telling how the Russian resistance is stiffening, and it is not impossible that the Russians will find their El Alamein at either Stalingrad or Rostov. And speaking of El Alamein, the Italians are once again excusing their standstill on the Egyptian front by saying that Egypt and the Caucasus are inseparable fronts, and that just as soon as the front of the Caucasus becomes a real one, the Egyptian front will suffer accordingly. But perhaps more significant in connection with the Egyptian front is a distinct change in Axis propaganda toward Turkey. You'll recall how, when the Axis were advancing by leaps and bounds across the Libyan desert, the Germans stated that Turkey would draw her own conclusions from this advance and jump on the Axis bandwagon. What happened? As far as this is known here, the Turks remain singularly aloof to this Axis propaganda. At least, she has made no move in the Axis direction. Failing in their earlier propagandistic attempts, the Germans have now invited a group of Turkish journalists to visit Germany, ostensibly to increase this propagandistic defect. Apparently, the German power of suggestion has failed again. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
And here is Ray Henley of the Washington Bureau of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, reporting from our nation's capital.
A brand new controversy is developing in Washington. Can we build, in mass production, monster flying boats, each capable of carrying up to 1,000 fully equipped men or large amounts of freight? If we can, many observers believe we could stop worrying about submarines. If we can't, the attempt to try it would waste precious critical materials. We may know more about where we stand after a conference planned here today by shipping officials who hope to solicit the views of President Roosevelt and the Maritime Commission. Henry J. Kaiser, the construction tycoon, who first proposed construction of the Glenn Martin 70-ton air giant called Mars, and to get ultimately into annual production of 5,000 huge flying boats of 125 tons. He said 9 shipyards should be converted to do the job. In Washington today, Kaiser is scheduled to talk with Andrew J. Higgins, New Orleans shipbuilder. Higgins held contracts to build 200 Liberty freighters, but he never completed his shipyards to build them. The War Production Board decided the steel should go directly into freighters ready for construction in established shipyards. Now Higgins says he is ready to change over his partially completed shipyards in jig time to flying boat construction. The Kaiser proposal has stirred the imagination of some officials. Others are pouring cold water on it. President Roosevelt and his military high command will have to decide what is to be done. 2 labor leaders are on record with statements on vital American problems. Joseph Curran, president of the National Maritime Union, tells President Roosevelt, "We believe the opening of a second front now is vital, not only to the cause of the United Nations, but to their security." From William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor, has come a blast against legislative freezing of wages. The Federation is demanding wage stabilization by voluntary agreements between management and workers, with final authority resting in the National War Labor Board. This board last week granted certain steelworkers a 44 cents per day increase. The Federation's blast was timed to precede any stand President Roosevelt may be planning to take on wage freezing for the duration. Members of Congress are waiting impatiently to learn if the President will support new price control legislation based on control of wages by law. Rubber is in the news again. Senator George W. Norris of Nebraska is demanding expansion of facilities to increase the amount of butadiene that could be made from grain alcohol. Senator Guy Gillette of Iowa is charging that officials fumbled in handling the synthetic rubber program. He also is demanding more rubber made from grain alcohol. War Production Chief Donald Nelson, however, is holding fast to his original program of 800,000 tons, all but 200,000 tons of it to be made from petroleum. He contends you will get no rubber at all if you keep on changing the specifications. The House has passed the biggest tax bill in American history. It is intended to raise better than $6.25 billion. However, do not be concerned too deeply at the moment with any particular phase of this measure. It is now before the Senate, and Senator Walter F. George, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, strongly indicates the measure will be rewritten there. Only this much can be said now with certainty. Taxes in all categories will be much higher. And that's all from Washington.
According to a dispatch from our New York newsroom, the Russians have not yet been able to bring to a full halt the German advance southward toward Rostov and the Black Earth country of the Don River Bend. These were the reports of Grant Parr from Cairo, Robert St. John from London, David Anderson from Stockholm, and Ray Henley from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.